When people try to read the Bible through from cover to cover, they usually get stuck in one of two places. They either get stuck in Leviticus, that's a favorite stopping off point when you're reading through the Bible, because suddenly all the stories stop and it's just law and ritual and things that seem a little irrelevant. The other place where people get stuck is in Chronicles. And when we read the Bible right through in our church, non-stop, there were two or three poor people who had to read the first nine chapters of Chronicles, which, if you know them, are nothing more than genealogies, family trees, just name after name after name, most of them quite unpronounceable to the English tongue. And the poor people read for 15 minutes nothing but old Hebrew names and all the begatting. It seems as if they did nothing much but begat in those days. And so-and-so begat so-and-so and so-and-so begat so-and-so. And it just goes on for nine whole chapters. And then when you get through that, you're into what looks like a repeat performance, because you've just been reading through 1 and 2 Kings, and now you're reading the whole story all over again. And it puzzles many people, why do we have two accounts of the same period of history? The kingdom of Israel. You get it first in Kings, and then exactly the same thing. And the same kings and the same events in Chronicles. Why? And we've got to begin our study of Chronicles by asking that question. Now, one of the difficulties we English have is the order of books in the English Bible, which is quite different from the order of books in the Jewish Bible. And I want to try and explain this with this chart. The Hebrew Old Testament is in the order of the first column and the second down to there. And the English order of books in the Old Testament is here and here. And we notice a number of things. First of all, they are grouped quite differently. There are three groups of books in the Hebrew Bible, which they call the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. And if you remember the story of Jesus on the road to Emmaus with the two disciples after his resurrection, it says he took them through the scriptures and showed them everything in the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings concerning himself. That was his Bible. That was the grouping. And you notice some real changes. First of all, the first five books of the Bible are all separated from the rest. They are the Law, or the Torah, which means maker's instructions. And the Torah, or the Pentateuch it sometimes calls, penta means five, and so the five books of the Law, what we call Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, they are actually called by the first words on each scroll. So Genesis is called in the beginning, Exodus is called these are the names, Leviticus is called anti-called, and Numbers is called in the wilderness, and Deuteronomy is called these are the words. But that's just because they're the first words, and they just unroll the scroll and see the first words, they know which one they've got. Then immediately they go into prophets, and they have two subgroups of prophets. They call Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, and Samuel is only one book in the Hebrew Old Testament. Kings is only one book, the reason being that when they only used consonants and not vowels, it only took up half the space. So, of course, when these were turned into first Greek and then English, they took up so much more space, it was divided into two books because the vowels doubled the length of words. That's the only reason. But these four books, they call them former prophets. Now, I tried to explain when we did Samuel and Kings that they're not history, they are prophetic insight into history. And Samuel was this prophet who dominated that earlier period. And during the period of the kings, there were dozens of prophets. And it was the prophets who wrote the history in many cases and who interpreted it and showed them what God was doing. And then they put the later prophets, the latter prophets, into another group. And that's how we do it as well. The coloring seems to have gone a bit astray there. But anyway, forget that. Then we have the writings. And this is a kind of miscellaneous box in which everything else goes. And the Psalms are in there, though they call that book praises. They don't call it Psalms, they call it praises. Book of Job is in there, Book of Proverbs. Ruth comes right out of here and down to here. It is not considered a prophetic book. So it goes into the writings. And that's a big change from our Bible. Song of Songs comes in here. Then Ecclesiastes comes in, but it's called the preacher. And Lamentations comes in, but as I told you, that is simply called How, because that's the first word in it. Esther, And Daniel is not put among the prophets. He's put in the writings. That's rather important to notice. Ezra and Nehemiah come in here. And finally, the last book in the Old Testament, in the Jewish Old Testament, is Chronicles. Only it's called simply the Words of the Days, a kind of record of history. In other words, the Book of Kings is regarded in a totally different light to the Book of Chronicles. One book is prophetic and the other's not. And we're going to see why in a moment. It means that the last word in the Old Testament in the Jewish Bible, or the Jewish Old Testament, is the word Aliyah, which means go up. And the last word in Chronicles is let us go up, meaning let's go back to Jerusalem. And ever since, whenever Jews go back to the Promised Land, they say, I'm making Aliyah. And Aliyah means I'm going up to Jerusalem. See? And that's a much better arrangement than the English, because the last word in English is curse. And you know, the Jews will never read Malachi to the last verse in the synagogue, because they will not finish with the word curse. I'll tell you what they do with it when we study Malachi. But you see, the order's quite different. And in Luke 24, we find Jesus opening the Bible the way the Jew opened it, showing them everything in the law, the prophets, and the writings concerning himself. Now, in English, we have three quite different groupings. We call all the first books of the Bible history, and we treat Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy as history, and lump it in with Joshua and Judges as if it just carries on. And we put Ruth in there, because we think it's part of the history. And we put Samuel, Kings, and we put Chronicles immediately after Kings. And that's why we tend to get the impression it's just saying the same thing over again. Actually, it isn't. When we look closely, it's a totally different kind of book. And it's not a prophetic book. But I'm afraid when you put them next door to each other in our Bible, we just think, oh, I've read all that in Kings, so I'll skip Chronicles. And we miss the message. And then it adds Ezra and Nehemiah in the history, though here it's in the writings. And then we put Esther in there as the last bit of history. And then we have a collection we call poetry, and we put in that Job, the drama of Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. That's what comes next. You can see we've completely changed the order. And then finally we get through to what we think is prophecy, and we don't divide them into former and latter. We divide them into major and minor. And say we've got four big ones and 12 little ones. And we put Daniel in there. Now, you see, it means that I'm afraid we Gentiles have misunderstood a lot of things, and we've got them in a quite different classification. And so we tend to treat Kings and Chronicles as the same kind of book. And certainly, if you don't study them carefully, you could come to that conclusion. The result is that the books of Chronicles are very little known in church circles. So much so that I think there are only two verses that we ever quote out of the whole books. One is 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. I don't know how many times I've heard that quoted over the last 20 years. Have you? There was a whole musical called If My People, based on that one verse. And yet the verse was taken right out of context. And it was made to apply to England, as if I will heal their land applied to England. Or America, since the musical was written there. But the land there is the land of Israel. And there is nothing to allow us to apply it to any other land. But I'm afraid it makes a good motto, if you know what I mean. And it was lifted out of context and become one of the most popular texts of the last 20 years. It's dying down a bit now. But it really, everywhere you went, it was, if my people, if my people. The other one is from the reign of King Jehoshaphat, when he was attacked by three separate nations who were allied together and said, we're going to wipe out little Judah. And they marched on Jehoshaphat, and he prayed and he sought the Lord, and the prophet said, you're going to win the battle. But he was told to send singers ahead of the army into battle. It's a classic case. And so the singers, the choir, led the army into battle and sang praises to God. And the enemy fled. And that is the other verse from Chronicles that really has been picked up. It's led to the Jesus marches. It's led to all kinds of things that if we lead with praise and send the choir out, we're going to beat the enemy. It's the other verse. But both of these verses, frankly, have been taken right out of context. And we've been singing the verse from Jehoshaphat's battle, "The battle is the Lord's. The battle belongs to the Lord." We've sung a song already today with that, or was it yesterday? And apart from that, people just don't know Chronicles. It's rather sad. But I want to show you that it's a book that has a message of its own, and not just a book to pick an odd text out of, but really to get hold of. Its message is quite different from the books of Kings. There are other duplications in the Bible. There are two accounts of creation in Genesis, one from God's point of view, one from man's point of view. There are four accounts of Jesus in the New Testament, and they are all complementary. There are things in the four Gospels that sound just the same, but they're coming from a different angle, because each Gospel was written for a different kind of person. And the same parable in two Gospels can have an entirely different message. The parable of the lost sheep in Luke's Gospel, which is written for unbelievers, the lost sheep is a sinner. But in Matthew, the same parable in a Gospel that was written for believers is a backsliding church member. So even one story has a different meaning because it's in a different book. See? And therefore the same stories about David and Solomon and Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah in Kings and Chronicles, the same story has an entirely different message. It's written from a different angle. So, we'll have to try and unravel the difference. And let me just remind you of things I've said earlier. All history has an angle. You can't write history without betraying your personal interest, because you select from all that happened, you select the things you're interested in and that you think are important. And then, having given that selection, you then connect them up to show how one thing led to another. And then you evaluate, you explain or evaluate what you've written, meaning you then have to say whether what you've written about was a good thing to happen or a bad thing to happen. So a historian, step one, selection. Step two, connection. Step three, evaluation or explanation. And that's when you make a moral judgment. And if you know that old history book, 1066 and all that, those moral judgments are made all the way through. This was a bad thing. This was a good thing to happen for England. And in the same way, you find the moral judgment, the evaluation in Kings is quite different from the book of Chronicles. Just to give you a clue straight away, the book of Kings concentrates on all the bad things the kings did, whereas the book of Chronicles concentrates on all the good things the kings did. It's as simple as that. Well, let's spell this out a bit and just tease it out so that you've got it. You see, again, taking the New Testament, what it says about the Old, it says the Old Testament was written as examples for us so that we can learn from these things. So why, in the book of Kings, are we told about all the bad things that kings did, and in the book of Chronicles, we're told about all the good things they did? You get quite a different picture. They were all sinners in Kings, and they're all saints in Chronicles. Now, is this distorting history, or what's happening? Why is there this difference of emphasis? Well, now let's draw the comparison between, you can come up and look at this closer later and see the difference, but it is very striking when Kings and Chronicles are together in English Bibles, but far apart in Jewish Bibles. Let's sort of contrast. I've talked about the selection of historical events and then their connection, so you explain how they link up, and then the evaluation that decides whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. But when we look at Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, we find, first of all, that Samuel and Kings between them, which were only two books in the Hebrew Testament, Old Testament, but are four books in ours, they cover a period of 500 years only. But when we come to Chronicles, we find it starts much earlier and it finishes later. Actually, that word is wrong. It should be later. It starts much earlier. It goes way back to Adam, right back through the centuries to the very beginning of the human race, and it finishes later, and it is this that is the key to the difference. Samuel and Kings finish in the exile. But here we have the return. Let us go up to Jerusalem is the last word in Chronicles. And therefore, these two writers had quite a different task in front of them, and they met that need quite differently. Here, there had to be an explanation as to why everything had gone wrong. But they now knew all that. Now they had to be picked up again and encouraged and sent back to build it all up again. This was written quite soon after the events. Most of this was written long after the events. Here we have a political history for the most part, but here we have a concentration on the religious history of the same period. This is from a prophetic viewpoint, but this is from a priestly viewpoint. This covers, of course, kings in the north and the south. But Chronicles, covering the same period, never mentions a single northern king. He is not interested in the north at all. That's a huge difference. Maybe you never spotted that. But above all, here, he concentrates on the human failings of the kings that led to disaster. But here, he wants to concentrate on the divine faithfulness. He's going to play down the royal vices, and he's going to play up the royal virtues. Again, we'll see why when we tease out the book. Therefore, this has a very negative view of the kings. This has a very positive view for a very real reason. It's not that he's trying to change history. It is a selection that's going on. And while he selects all the bad things the kings did, he selects all the good things they did. Same kings, and they were a mixture of good and bad. Here, the emphasis is moral, and the key word is righteousness. Were these kings righteous or not? But here, there is an interest more in ritual again, in the temple and the sacrifices. And the interest is in spiritual rather than moral issues. And so we have here a prophet writing and here a priest writing. And the difference of viewpoint is enormous. Well, now those are some of the differences. And we must now ask, so what is happening? I think one of the best ways is to ask, what Chronicles is leaving out that Kings and Samuel put in? Clearly, a great deal is, because there's quite a different proportion of chapters to each king. For example, over there, in Samuel and Kings, Saul has about a sixth of the book. Here, hardly anything. Half, at least. Sorry, Samuel I'm talking about. No, I'm talking about Saul. David, here, is about two-thirds of what he has there. Solomon, about half. The divided kingdom, again, about half. So what's going on? What is he leaving out? Let's be specific. Number one, he leaves out entirely Samuel's part in choosing kings. That's not mentioned. Secondly, he leaves Saul almost out altogether. He only records Saul's death. That's because he wants them to see kings in a good light. So most of Saul's reign is just not there. However, David, there's an awful lot there, but what is missed out? All his struggles with Saul, missed out. His seven-year reign in Hebron is missed out. His many wives are missed out. Absalom's rebellion is missed out. And above all, the whole episode with Bathsheba that was the turning point in David's reign is not there. Now, this is all very significant. The man is deliberately playing up the kings. If he can say something good about them, he does. If he can't, he doesn't. And even with those he says good things about, if there are bad things, he misses them out. Fancy missing out David and Bathsheba, which was such a turning point. But it's not there. David here appears in a wonderful light. So does Solomon. There's not a word here about his many wives or the idols that were brought into the palace. His faulty relationship with God is not mentioned. His failure to deal with the high places, the pagan temples, not mentioned. And then when we get to the divided kingdom, nothing about the kings in the north, because they were all bad. And when we come to the kings of the south, we find that he really gives a lot of space to the good kings, like the boy King Josiah and King Hezekiah, but the bad kings, hardly there at all. Now, the man is not prejudiced. He's doing it quite deliberately. He has certain interests. There are common threads that run right through that were not prominent in Saul's reign, but were in David and Solomon's and some of the kings of Judah. First of all, he is only concerned with the royal line of David, only concerned with kings that are in that royal line. Since none of the kings of the north were, they don't belong. This is a history of the royal house of David and no one else. Saul is not in it because he wasn't in the royal line of David. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. Northern kings are not in it. But one man who is in this book, who's not in those, is a man called Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel was the royal line of David who came back from Babylon exile. And it was in him that their hopes for the Messiah lay, because he was the only one who came back from David's line, Zerubbabel. And so he spends, when he goes through the genealogy, there's half a chapter on Zerubbabel's family tree, which is something quite new. He is not idolizing royalty, but he is what I would call idealizing royalty, painting it in a very favorable light. He doesn't highlight their differences, or rather their weaknesses. Now, is there a particular aspect of these good kings' reign that he concentrates on? Yes, there is. He is concerned with their attitude to two things, the ark and the temple. And he concentrates entirely on what they did about the Ark of the Covenant and a temple to house it as the place where God could live among his people. And all that it says about David is how he brought the Ark to Jerusalem, his desire to build a temple, his preparation for it, gathering the materials, drawing the plans, how he arranged the services of worship and the choirs and the choir masters. All this is in great detail in Chronicles. And yet it's almost skipped over in the book of Kings, Samuel. So he's got a real interest in the place of worship. And Solomon, of course, pretty well all he tells us about him is how he built the temple that his father David couldn't. And how he prayed at the end when it was dedicated, and how the glory of the Lord came. All about that underground quarry. You remember the no sound of hammer or chisel was heard because he was quarrying it underneath the hill in the cave. That's in Chronicles. It's not in Kings, actually. It's all over here. And these kings, in the writer's eyes, were good because they helped to keep the worship of the temple going. Well, now, a priest would say that, wouldn't he? A prophet would concentrate. You see, a prophet would concentrate on the bad things they did that got the land into trouble. But the priest says he built a temple for us. He got the choirs organized. He got the worship. And David was known to them as the man who was the worship leader and the psalm writer and the man who wanted the temple built and so on. So we've got David and Solomon, and almost everything we're told about is what they did about the temple. When we pass on from Solomon and there is the great civil war and the 10 tribes in the north split from the 2 tribes in the south, he's only interested in the south because that's where the temple is. That's where the priests of God are, and that's where the royal line is kept. So he's staying with this interest. And he picks out really only 8 good kings, 5 of them outstandingly good. And the 12 bad kings in the south he ignores. So again, you can see his mind, can't you, ticking. And he picks out Asa, and King Asa put away the idols in Judah and Benjamin, and removed his queen mother from the palace because she was secretly worshipping an idol in her bedroom. And Asa made a covenant with the Lord, and he enriched the temple with silver and gold. So in a priest's eyes, he's a good man. Got it? Then Jehoshaphat, who was Asa's son, he sent the Levites throughout Judah, teaching in every city, teaching them the law of God. And he got victory over Ammon and Moab when he said, the battle is not yours but God's, and he sent the singers into battle. But I'm afraid he did something bad. He married Ahab's daughter. And in fact, through that alliance, a terrible thing happened. Jezebel's daughter, Athaliah, came south and made a bid for the throne and killed all the royal seed of David, all the princes, she murdered. She wanted the throne. But that's when a priest, notice that, a priest, Jehoiada, kidnapped the youngest prince, Joash, and hid him and produced him later. Said, this is your rightful king. And Ataliah got her comeuppance. But you see, once again, there's a priest who played a crucial part in preserving the royal line of David. You don't read about that in the other. Then Joash, he repaired the temple. And he did good things. And then Hezekiah, we know about. He reopened and repaired the temple. And they celebrated a Passover with great joy. And his reforms, which only have a few verses in Kings, there are three chapters about him over here. Because he reformed the worship and put the temple right. And then Josiah, he talks about him a lot. That boy king who again, spring cleaned the temple, found the book of the law and put back into the temple all the proper services and the feasts that they should have been observing. Now, all these kings opposed idolatry. That's why in the priest's eyes they were good. And the interesting thing is this, idolatry was one of the things that bad kings got into that the prophets denounced. But when the Jews came back from exile, they never again got into idolatry, and they haven't to this very day. They learned their lesson in the exile, and never again has a Jew worshipped an idol in the last 2,500 years. Interesting. And of course the priest was thrilled to bits with that. Because whereas the prophets tended to concentrate on immorality and injustice, the priests were most worried about idolatry. Now, all this is telling us something. The book ends, actually, Chronicles ends, with Cyrus the Persian overcoming the Babylonians and sending the Jews back to their land to rebuild the temple. Now, I want you to bear in mind that the people for whom this person is writing are the people coming back from exile who've been born in a foreign land, who've never seen a Jewish temple, and who aren't ruled over by a prince of David. And what he's doing is to tell them three things. I call them the three R's. He wants to give them roots, royalty, and religion again. The first thing they need to know as they come back to their own land is who they are. They need to know their identity. Let's move on. I'm over here now. The returning exiles, first of all, needed to know who they were. That they had roots. And those roots went far back into history, right back to Adam. But he had to re-educate them all over again and take them right through from Adam, right through to where they are now. If you've read Alex Haley's books, Roots, or seen the film, that's a fascinating story about how a black man in America wanted to find out where he came from, who he was, and how he found his way right back to a river in West Africa, where a young boy called Kunta Kinte had been kidnapped and sold as a slave to America. And he found his roots and went back to the village and found people there, still there, to whom he was related. And he suddenly felt, I know who I am. I know where I've come from, I know where I belong, where I fit into history. Now, the Jews needed this when they came back. They needed roots going right back. They needed to know that they had a line that God had been controlling all the way down, that they belonged to God and that he'd singled them out from the whole human race and selected Abraham and so on. And that's why Chronicles went right back to the very beginning. They needed roots. They needed identity. A rooted people. The second thing they needed was to know that they were a royal people and that they had their own king and they had their own royal line. They were going back to the land, and he wanted them to start thinking about the king again, to restore the kingdom of Israel. So they were going to need leadership. And he's telling them, you're not just a group of people, misfits. You are a royal priesthood. You are a royal people. You have a king, and the royal line has been preserved, and you're going to be a kingdom again. And the third thing that he wanted to convey to them is not just their identity and not just the matter of leadership, but the purpose for which they existed as a people. And that purpose was religious. The most important thing that made them what they were was the fact that they were God's chosen people, and that their worship of God was absolutely central to their identity as a people. And so when they went back, the first priority was to get a temple built and to get worship reestablished. It's interesting that of those who went back, nearly over 10% of those who went back were priests, which is a far higher proportion than the number of priests in the whole people. So why did more priests than anybody else go back from Babylon, the end of the exile? The answer was they had the right reason for going back. Many of the others had settled down, got businesses going and prospered, were very comfortable. But the priests had no temple. And they wanted to get back to reestablish the worship of God, to get the temple up. So more priests, when Zerubbabel called for volunteers to offer to trek across the Arabian desert and go back to that land that they'd never seen and build a temple, it was the priests who said, we'll go. And out of all proportion to their numbers, the priests led the way back. And their leader was a man called Joshua. Well, now you can see these three purposes of Chronicles very clearly. You are a rooted people. You have a history. You belong. This is your family tree. It's a very special family tree. And you are a royal people. You're a kingdom. And you're going to have a king. In fact, you've got one. We've preserved the royal line. And Zerubbabel is the prince. And you are a religious people. And you need to get back to worship. That is the most important reason for going back. And therefore, the first thing you must get built is a temple where you can praise God. Because that's the reason you're called a Jew. Jew means praise God. That's the whole reason for you going back there, to establish God's name in his city again. So the book was, if you like, a sermon for that returning remnant. And we know they were very discouraged when they went back. It wasn't a very exciting business. They had to struggle to make a living. They were very poor. They were very slow building the temple. It needed two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, just to keep them going. But we'll see that when we study those books. But he had to get this instilled into them. God must come first in your life as a people. That's why we're going back. We're going back to be God's people, not just to have a home of our own. Alas, Israel today is largely there because they wanted a home of their own where they could be safe. They did not really go back to establish themselves as God's people. Never forget, 3/4 hour I had with the president of Israel in his palace. And at the end of the talk, he said, well, I'm an agnostic. I don't really believe in God. This was President Navon of Israel. And I said, but this is the land where God did his greatest miracles. He said, well, I can't believe it. I was sad. You see, it was so important that they went back as a religious people, as God's people, and that the temple should be the very center of their return and the very center of their hopes. That's why he wrote it. And you can see the message is quite different from the prophetic message. This is what happened to get you into this mess. It's too late now to say all that. They're in the mess. Now he's wanting to lift them up and say, let's go back and start again. And so he inspires them with these wonderful stories of the past. Let me just quickly bring the threads together. Christ himself picked up all these threads in himself. That's why Matthew begins with the genealogy of Christ. In fact, Luke takes it right back to Adam. It's almost as if you hear the genealogy all over again. Because Christ had roots. Christ was and is a Jew. He's still a Jew. And it's important that we know that he was not a rootless person. He came from these roots. Furthermore, he was the fulfillment of their royal line. He was the son of David. And he could inherit that throne twice over. Through his father, he had a legal right to it, and through his mother, a physical right to it. Because they both came from the line of David. And he was also the fulfillment of their religious hopes, the temple, because he actually became the temple. It says, the Word was made flesh and tabernacled among us. He said, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. He saw himself as the focus of their worship. So these three things you see coming together in Christ. I haven't time to show how it all comes together in Christ. But now these three things are passed on to us. And we inherit the three R's. Because we have been grafted into Jewish roots, so their genealogy is ours. When I read Chronicles 1 to 9, I'm reading my family tree. Because I'm now a son of Abraham. I've been grafted into their roots. Their roots are mine. These are my forefathers. And when you're a Christian, your true roots are now Jewish. They're even more significant to you than your family tree physically. Because that family tree will disappear at death. But it's the Jewish family tree that is now your genealogy. In Christ, you inherit the blessings of Abraham. You're part of this. You're now a rooted people, but your roots are Jewish. The olive tree is Jewish. And we are now royal people. We are a royal priesthood. You are princes and princesses. You should walk down the street like a prince or like a princess. I've said that to many hangdog Christians whose heads were down. And I've said, lift your head up. You're a prince. You're a princess. Behave like one. There are too many others not behaving like one. You behave like them. We are the royal family and we're going to reign over this world with Christ. It says he has redeemed from every kindred and tribe and tongue men for God and they shall reign on the earth. We're going to reign. We are the royal family of England. And we should behave that way. Puts a responsibility on us. But you've got royal blood in you now. It's the blood of Jesus. And we have become the temple. Don't you know your bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit? Don't you know that you, corporately in the church, are the temple of God, wherein he dwells? So that these three things, which the people returning from the exile needed to be taught, we need to claim because they are ours. We are a rooted people, a royal people, and a religious people. We're the temple of God. And yet there is a difference. We are still in exile. We haven't come home yet. We're strangers and pilgrims in a foreign land. Though you may say, but I'm English and I live in England or whatever, you don't belong here. Your citizenship is in heaven. And you're a stranger. And people will regard you as that. Somehow you're a misfit. Brother, they think gypsies are misfits. I tell you, the world thinks every Christian is. And Jesus said, they hated me, so they're likely to hate you. We don't belong. It's amazing how quickly your friends drop you. Somebody once asked the great Baptist preacher, C.H. Spurgeon. It was a girl, and she'd just been converted, and she said, how many of my old friends should I give up now? He said, don't bother. He said, they'll give you up quick enough. See, and I'm afraid that is true. And you find yourself more closely related to people who are not your physical relatives, but who are your spiritual family. And you've got to work hard to keep your relationships with your unbelieving relatives. Because now you belong to a new family, royal family. And you're the temple of God. What you do with your body, you're doing with the temple of God. It's one reason why I've noticed so many people give up smoking when they become Christians. Now, there's nothing in the Bible against smoking. And it won't take you to hell. It only makes you smell as if you've already been there. But suddenly, I've known Christian men say, what am I doing to the temple of God? I'm making it smell, I'm making it dirty, and I'm shortening its life. They give it up. When you see your body as the temple of God, get a different idea about it. See? So we are now inheriting the teaching of Chronicles. And I hope that's helped to make it not just a dull old bit of history, but made it a different book. It's got quite a different message to Kings. Quite a different message. And a message of hope for the future and what we're here for, why we're here, and how to find our true identity as the people of God in a strange land. Well, let's read that book in a new way. Get some new lessons from it. Well, we come to three minor prophets, the last prophets to speak for God to Israel: Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And after that, God didn't say another thing for over 400 years. And for four centuries, they had to tell their children, someday God will speak to us again. But he just went dumb for 400 years. A long time not to hear from someone you love. But that's what happened. So we're getting to the very last part of the Old Testament when we look at Haggai and Zechariah particularly. There was only one further one after that, and then God just was finished talking to Israel until John the Baptist appeared 400 years later. No wonder everybody went out to hear John when you've waited 400 years to hear a prophecy and you finally hear that God is speaking again. Boy, it's no wonder the whole country went to listen. But they had some last words from Haggai particularly. Now these are very short books because these prophets spoke for a very short time. Haggai only spoke for 3 months. Then he was finished. Zechariah was a bit longer. He was 2 years. And they actually overlapped. Zechariah started before Haggai finished. But they just said a little, but a very important little. Whereas Isaiah and Jeremiah had preached for 40 to 50 years. Now they just spoke a matter of months. They are what we call post-exilic prophets. They came after the exile. They were part of the coming home again. And that's the background to both Haggai and Zechariah. Before the exile, the prophets were full of warnings and disasters coming. But afterwards, it's quite different. They are full of encouragement, of comfort, trying to get the thing built up again. And so the message is quite different. Now, Haggai and Zechariah are among the very last, but they go together, and there are many similarities between them. First of all, they spoke at the same time. Both of them carefully dated their prophecies, which few of the other earlier prophets had ever done. But they actually date them to the day and the month and the year when they said things. So each prophecy of Haggai, and he gave five, each has a date, an exact date. So we can see just how many days or weeks there lay between each of them. And same with Zechariah. They overlapped by just 1 month, and the year is 520 BC. They're back in the land, but it's a rather depressing picture. They both spoke in the same place, the slow rebuilt city of Jerusalem in Judah. And they both spoke to exactly the same situation. Now, I must give you a bit of history just to help you to see what was happening. The Persian Cyrus, or Cyrus as we should call him, conquered Babylon in 538 BC. And because he was such a better dictator, more benevolent one, a humane man, he said all those who were taken from their country can go back, provided you build a temple in which you can pray to your God for me. So that he was not entirely disinterested in this, but nevertheless, it made it possible for Jews, among others, to return to their home. But only 50,000 did so. And the rest, having largely been born in exile, having established themselves, they weren't slaves in Babylon. They were allowed to trade. And Babylon was right on the main river there, and was a trade route. And the Jews are good at trading and making money. And they became quite wealthy, and they had businesses that depended on the trade route through Babylon. There was no trade route through Jerusalem. So I'm afraid many of them said, we're staying. This is what keeps Jews, or kept them in Germany and Poland, up to World War II. This is what's keeping them in America. They're better off. And many Jews who came out of Russia recently didn't go to Israel, though. That's why they came out of Russia. They went straight off to New York, because they're better off there. And there are Jews leaving Israel today and going to live in America. And you wonder how long they'll be there without trouble before God says, you've got to go back. Anyway, only 50,000 came. The rest stayed. There was a huge Jewish colony in Babylon from then on. And as I've told you already, it was from that colony that wise men saw the star that Balaam the prophet had predicted and came to Bethlehem to see the Messiah. Now those who did come back were led by two men. One was a prince, Zerubbabel. And that name means seed of Babylon. Babel, Babel, Babylon, same word. And Zeru means seed. So it's clear that he'd been born in exile. He'd never seen the promised land, but he was the only surviving member of the royal line of David. So he had to go back. And the man who accompanied him was a priest called Joshua, a descendant of Iddo. And Joshua reestablished the priesthood. Joshua is the same name as Jesus. Yeshua, Joshua, same word. It means God saves. God our Savior. And so Joshua went back to reestablish the priesthood and the temple. Those who came back were primarily motivated by spiritual interests. They certainly weren't motivated by any commercial attraction. They were not going to be wealthy. It was going to be a hard struggle. They were going back to a land that hadn't been cultivated for 70 years. They were going back to a city in which there was not a wall standing. And they were going back into a place where the people who had survived there didn't want them. They were called Samaritans. They were half Jewish. But the few Jews who'd managed to stay in the promised land married non-Jews, and it became a kind of half-caste race. And they were regarded, both by the Jews and the locals, much as coloureds were regarded in South Africa. Hybrids. You don't fit either. And that's the beginning of the Jewish-Samaritan hatred of each other. Why Jesus told such an offensive story about a good Samaritan helping a Jew. That really got under their skin. So the Samaritans were living there and they didn't want the Jews to come back. And so it was not a very promising future. But their first concern on going back was to build an altar. And their second concern was to build a temple around it. To reestablish themselves as God's people. That's why so many priests, it was actually 2 out of every 15, were priests who went back. Now, do you realize they were tracing the exact same route that Abraham had gone? Because Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham had lived, is just down the river from Babylon. And they were going to have to repeat the whole story of Abraham again and leave their home and leave their relatives and leave their business and go out to a country they'd never seen, and they would take exactly the same route that Abraham took. And the first thing that Abraham did when he got to the promised land, he pitched his tent and raised an altar. Wherever that man went, he put up his tent, and the next thing he got some stones together and made an altar and gave a sacrifice of thanksgiving to God that he'd safely arrived. And that was the first thing they did when they went back. And the very first step in Jerusalem was to gather a few of the stones and make an altar and thank God for getting them back. The next thing was to get the temple built, put a building. And because there were few of them and they had no resources, they decided to build a very much smaller temple. Just a little one. But at least it was a temple. And they laid the foundations, this little square building around the altar. Now all this had involved great sacrifice. They'd left friends, relatives. They'd left brick-built homes for temporary accommodation and tents. They'd left prosperity for poverty. They'd left trading for agriculture. They must now learn to dig again. It was a very costly business, but they had their dream, and their dream from the book of Chronicles was of re-establishing a royal kingdom with their own king, and to be again a people of God in the land God had promised their forefathers. But the good old days did not come back. The dream faded. Fantasy gave way to reality, and the size of the task discouraged them and their hearts sank. The opposition of the local people, the Samaritans, to their return was very strong. And the subsidy, Cyrus had given them financial help to go back and rebuild, and that stopped when Darius replaced Cyrus and got involved in wars which were expensive, and the first economy he made was to cut off the subsidies that had been given to returning peoples to build temples. So they now found themselves without money. So they stopped building. After only 2 years, and for 14 years, they didn't put another stone on the temple. Just the foundations were in and low walls. But that was all. And after 2 years, they gave up. They hadn't the money. They were struggling to stay alive, to scratch a living from the poor soil. And it was just too much. on top of scratching a living to be building temples, that was a luxury they couldn't afford. Their concern now was mere survival. Then their economy went into severe recession. Food became scarce and very expensive. Inflation rocketed. And bad harvests reduced the supply of food. Droughts and disease hit the corn. They had no savings. They'd spent all the money they'd saved in Babylon on just food and clothing. It was a huge anticlimax. Everything had gone wrong. They'd come home with these hopes of rebuilding a nation, and now they could hardly stay alive. And of course they discussed the question, why has it turned out like this? And they came up with their own answers. They hadn't been wrong to return, but they had chosen the wrong time. And they began to say, we should have stayed longer in Babylon and built up more money for ourselves and waited until we were fit enough to come back and could come back in strength and come back with wealth, and then we could have done it. But we chose the wrong time. We're not in the wrong place, but we chose the wrong time to come. We're having to overstretch ourselves. We should have been established as a people first when we'd multiplied and prospered and... Though Abraham may have been content with a tent and an altar, we're not. We want to rebuild. They'd been back 18 years and had so little to show for it. Now, I'm trying to depress you. I want you to feel the depression they were in. And that's when Haggai spoke to them. He'd come back with them from exile. I think he was probably a priest, but we don't know who his father was, so he wasn't a very important person. Important people knew who their father was. It is not poetry, it's all prose. Now that is very significant, because there are no feelings of God come through at all. It's as if God is fed up, as if he doesn't feel anymore. That's very significant. But the word of the Lord came, not to Haggai as to other prophets, but by Haggai, which means that it was a word of insight rather than revelation, that he saw what was really wrong. And why the dream had collapsed and why it was all so depressing. He could see it. But he brought word after word from the Lord 26 times in just 38 verses. Thus saith the Lord. And he brought the word of the Lord to them in this second shortest book in the Old Testament. There are actually, these are the messages which he brought. I've even put the dates on them. That was in the first of the sixth month in the second year of Darius. That's in the 24th of the same month. And then the 21st of the seventh month. Then the 24th of the ninth month. And finally, again on the 24th of the ninth month. 5 days, that's all. And yet he brought 26 words from the Lord over 5 days. And they grouped around certain things. And he came asking questions. Chapters 1 to 3 are all about questions. From the Lord. The Lord questions the people. He makes them think. Because the real problem is that their thinking has gone wrong. And when your feelings are depressed, it's usually because your thinking has gone wrong. You're thinking the wrong way. You need to revise your thoughts. And then your feelings will follow. You need to think again. But it's amazing, God's people don't like to think. I'm sorry, but the most common comment I get after I preach is, well, you gave us something to think about. And it's always said in a tone of mild rebuke, as much as say, I didn't come to church to think. You know? But in fact, sometimes preachers and prophets need to make people think and provoke them to think again and to ask questions. And that's how Haggai tackled the situation. And he said, basically, your thinking is all wrong. Now, I've given you a very simple outline of the 5 days of his preaching. I'm just going to go through them now and pick out some of these questions that he asked on behalf of God. He was trying to get them to rethink. You see, they had come up with this answer that, in fact, God had caused this disaster, this disappointment, and they were suffering from it. But actually, it was the other way around. They had caused it. God was simply responding to them. They had actually taken the first steps into this depression, into this recession, into this time of inflation. He says, now your food is short and your money's short. You put your money into a bag with holes and it just seems to go. That's a vivid phrase. In time of inflation and recession, that's exactly how people feel. You put your money in your pocket and it's not there. It's put in a bag with holes, and your food, your crops have failed. And you've come to the conclusion that it's the wrong time to build the temple, that you can't afford the energy or the money to build a temple. He said, actually, all this happened because you stopped building the temple. It was the other way around. You shouldn't be saying we can't afford to build the temple in this time of inflation. What caused the inflation? It was you stopping building the temple. As soon as you stopped putting God first and his house first, that's when things began to go wrong, but you didn't notice. And so it was, you know, was the hen or the egg first? Which was the cause, which was the effect? And they were thinking exactly the opposite way. And so he said, now give careful thought to your ways. Think about what you did. And it was you who stopped building the temple first. And then he really began to attack them, because he says, look at your houses. Wood paneling. Now you must realize that when they went back, wood was very scarce. The trees had all been chopped down by the Babylonians. And they had to import wood from places like Lebanon, where there were cedar trees. And so a person with a ceiled house, that was something. A person with a panel dining room, they're spending a lot on their own house. And he's saying, each of you is living in an ideal home. He said, look at your houses and what you've spent on them. And look at God's house. Walls only up this high. You're more concerned about your own house than his house. That's what's caused the recession. That's why God isn't blessing your harvest. That's why inflation is running away with your money. You're not putting God first. It's a very simple message. He says, just compare your own home with God's home. And that'll tell you where your priorities have been. Well, that message had a real effect. They really responded positively. They said, come on lads, let's build the temple. And he really was a successful prophet. Where the prophets before the exile were largely failures, the prophets afterwards seemed to have been listened to. They'd learned their lesson in the exile. And so they got going, and as soon as they did, Haggai's last word to them on that first day was, thus says the Lord, I am with you again. Off we go. And so they stirred up. They took a little time, 3.5 weeks, to get the builders organized and to get more material for the temple. But 3.5 weeks later, they were off and building. The second message comes the 21st of the seventh month, just 27 days after they began building, less than a month later. And now morale was declining, largely through old people talking. It's so very human, this. It says the old people are saying, it's nothing like the temple in my day. You know? There were old people who'd come back who remembered the previous temple. This is a poor little thing, isn't it? Call this a temple, you should have seen the temple we had. Now, this kind of encouragement really is devastating. It's not like it was in my day. You know, you look back through rose-colored spectacles anyway. You can't trust elderly people talking like that to be remembering correctly sometimes. But that's what they were doing. And it was terribly discouraging. And it was undermining the work. And Haggai had to speak again from the Lord to keep them building. And he said, don't despise the day of small things. Better begin small than not at all. Let's get a temple up. God's not so worried about the size of his house. He just wants a house to live in where he can dwell among his people. So don't despise the day of small things. Lovely message, isn't it? And he got them going again. And he made promises. And again he said in the name of the Lord, I am with you. My spirit remains with you. And also he gave a message three times. He said, be strong. And once he said, and don't be afraid. And we've made a chorus out of that, haven't we? Be strong, for I the Lord, be bold, for I the Lord am with you. That's straight out of Haggai's second little message. Some of these choruses really pick up these messages, but unfortunately we sing them and we don't remember when they were given. And we need the context to understand the real meaning of these songs. Then he talked about the future in the second day he spoke to them. Talked about the future, that God would shake the heavens and the earth and shake the nations. that he was in control of nature and history. And then a very strange and difficult verse to translate comes up, and the desire of all nations will come. Now I'm afraid too many think that's the promise of the Messiah, the desired of all the nations will come. It's a very difficult bit of Hebrew, but I'll tell you what I think it means. That word desired is usually translated in the Old Testament as valuables, as treasures which you desire. And I think it's a promise that further silver and gold will come and help to restore the temple to its original condition. It's saying the treasures of the nations will come. I'm going to shake the nations and they'll send their treasures here. And in fact that happened, because shortly after that prophecy, a whole wave of silver and gold came from Babylon, or from Persia as it was now, to help with the rebuilding. So I think that's what it means. We read too much into it if we think that means the Messiah will come. And then God says, I will fill this house with my glory, and the glory of this house will be greater than the glory of the former house. And in fact, ultimately it was, because during Jesus' day, that second temple was rebuilt by Herod. And it became the most magnificent temple the world had ever seen. Though it was never actually finished, even in Jesus' day. But God was really saying, it's my glory that will make this house beautiful. And the glory of this later house, this second temple, will be greater than the former, the first temple. So with all these promises, Haggai kept them going. And then the next crisis came 2 months later, because a problem arose. It was now 2 months later into December, and there was no rain. Now you see, Haggai had said, you caused this drought and the famine and the shortage of food because you stopped building the temple. And now they came back to him and said, now we're building the temple again. We've been building it for 2 months, 3 months. There's no rain. Now rain is expected in October. That's the early rain. And it hadn't come still by December. And they're saying, hey, just a minute. You said everything would go right when we started rebuilding. And we've rebuilt so much. Look, we're getting the roof on now. And God hasn't sent the rain. It's going to be another bad harvest. Now this is a bit of a problem for Haggai. You can imagine there's a theological problem here. He said, this needs careful thought. 3 times he said it. And then he said, there must be a reason why God hasn't responded immediately to your rebuilding. Must be a reason. He said, God, what's the problem? And God told him. And he went with new questions to the people. He said, tell me, if you put a stack of dirty plates with a stack of clean plates, do the clean plates make the dirty plates clean? Or do the dirty plates make the clean plates dirty? Nice little question. What's the answer? If you put dirty and clean things together, do the dirty things make the clean things dirty, or do the clean things make the dirty things clean? You know the answer? Right. And then he said, and here's another question. If a thing is consecrated to the Lord and you put it with something unconsecrated, does the consecration pass over from the consecration to the unconsecrated? The answer is no. And then he said, now if you think about that, you've got the answer to why God hasn't put the harvest right. He said, you're building a consecrated temple, but unconsecrated people are doing it. Dirty people are building a clean temple, and that's making this new temple dirty in God's sight. He said, the real problem is, you think you're godly because you're building a temple, but actually, you're not godly people. And you're contaminating the temple in God's sight because you're not putting your lives right. And they got the message. And they began to clean themselves up. We don't know what the sins were. Haggai didn't mention them, but they knew. They knew what he was talking about. They knew what they were doing secretly and on the side. And God said, I don't want dirty people building my clean temple. That's what's wrong. And they put it right. And the rain began the next day. Haggai was a good prophet, you know. He really got through with his sermons, or rather with his questions. And he really got them going. And the rain started, even though it was December. And the word from the Lord was, from this day I will bless you. Because they got the message. The fourth day was the 24th of the ninth month. And this time it was a message for Zerubbabel and for him alone. And the message was, you are the signet ring of God. The signet ring is always worn by royalty. And what God was saying is, Zerubbabel, from you the royal line will be reestablished. He was the prince in David's line. But of course he couldn't ever be king, because under the Persian king, nobody else was allowed to be a king. They could be governor. And so Zerubbabel was made the governor of Judah under the king of Persia, now Darius. But he couldn't be king. But the promise was made in this, where are we now? The fourth message over here on the 24th of the ninth month. The promise was made to Zerubbabel. But there'll come a day when I shake the nations, and when I shake them, I will establish, I'll overthrow their thrones, and I'll establish the throne of Israel. And your line will be on it. I'm into number five, sorry. Yes, I am. All right. So he promises to Zerubbabel that he will shake the foreign nations. He will shake Persia, Egypt, Syria, Greece, and even Rome. And he will reestablish the kingdom of Israel from Zerubbabel's line. And on that day, he says, I will take you and I will make you my signet ring, which the king always uses to seal documents. For I have chosen you. Now, this was never actually fulfilled for Zerubbabel himself, but there is an extraordinary thing that happens when you study the genealogy of Jesus. There are two genealogies of Jesus, and it's a problem to some people. They seem to contradict each other, but one is of Joseph in Matthew, and one is of Mary in Luke. But these two family lines, which both went back to David, separated after David, and they came together again in one man, Zerubbabel, and then they separated again. Isn't that interesting? So that in fact, the name which appears in both Joseph's genealogy in Matthew 1 and in Mary's genealogy in Luke 3 contains this special name. Ancestor of Jesus on both his father's and his mother's side. As David was ancestor on both his father and mother's side. So Zerubbabel has a very, very important place in the history of our salvation. And God fulfilled his promise to that man by putting him on both sides of the genealogy of his son. I've told you already that Jesus traced his legal line back to David through his father, stepfather Joseph. Traced his physical line back to David through Mary. So he had this double claim. But the claim went, both claims went back through this man as well. Do you ever notice that? Read the two genealogies. I think that's a lovely thought. The message of Haggai may be summed up very quickly. First things first. And particularly put God first. And that theme is taken up by Jesus again and again in his teaching. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. And matters like food and clothes, you won't need to worry about. All these things will be added to you. But you know, so often we say, it's just so much keeping body and soul together in life. I really don't have time for religion. I've got to work so hard to just keep alive. But you know, the best welfare state ever is the kingdom of heaven. Because Jesus said, you seek the kingdom first, put God first, and all these other things will look after themselves. He doesn't promise us luxury. He promises that everything we need will be supplied. As a little boy reciting Psalm 23 said, the Lord's my shepherd, that's all I want. And it is true. When it says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, that means I shall not need. It doesn't mean I'll get everything I want. We're not promised that, but we are promised that if we put God first, he looks after the requirements of life, the necessities of life. That's a promise. But so often we tend to put making a living or keeping alive first and God can have what's left. But that's not the way it works. And Haggai's message comes through to us very clearly. If you put your own house before the house of God, it won't work out. God must come first. And then the other things will be provided. There's a more important aspect too. God is concerned about not what we do for him, but whether we're clean to do it. Or whether we're contaminating even the good things we're doing for him, because we're not keeping clean ourselves. That's why Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, when you bring an offering to the Lord, and there's a brother that you need to be reconciled to, you better go and put that right first before you bring the offering to the Lord. Once again, Haggai's message is coming through. Dirty people can make clean things dirty. Get things right. Put God first. Get things right. And then God can welcome what you do for him and bless you and look after you. It's really quite a simple message, but it's a message that perhaps still needs to be made. It's not staying alive or making a living. It is living right and living for God. Thank you, Haggai, for reminding us of that. And praise God, the people listened. And they put it right. And they got on with rebuilding the temple of the Lord. But 1 month before Haggai finished, another message was needed. And this time another man came, Zechariah. And we'll look at him next time.